Jake Barton realized that there was only one way to prevent a confrontation between the Italian force, which had appeared so silently and menacingly at the wells, and the undisciplined mob of warriors and camp followers of the Rasi's entourage. There was no chance that he could make himself heard in the hubbub of anxiously raised voices and emotional outbursts of Amaric, as the Ras tried to make his view heard above the attempts of 50 of his chieftains and captains to do exactly the same thing. Jake needed an interpreter, and he thrust his way towards Gregorius Mariam, grabbed him firmly by the arm, and dragged him out of the cave. It needed considerable force, for Gregorius was as intent as everybody else in having his views and suggestions aired. Jake was surprised to find how light it was outside the caves, and that the night had passed so swiftly. Dawn was only minutes away, and the dry desert air was sweet and heady after the crowded cave with its smoking fires. In the light of the campfires and the pale sky, he saw the mob streaming away down the wadi towards the wells, as happily excited as the crowds at a fairground. "Stop 'em, Greg," he shouted. "Come on, we gotta stop 'em." And the two of them ran forward. "What is it, Jake?"
"We gotta stop 'em running into the Itai camp."
"Why?"
"If somebody starts shooting, there'll be a massacre."
"But we're not at war, Jake."
"They can't shoot."
"Don't bet on it, buddy boy," grunted Jake grimly, and his alarm was contagious. Side by side, they caught up with the straggling rear of the column and elbowed and kicked their way through it.
"Back, you bastards!" roared Jake. "Get back, all of you!"
They made the meaning clear with flying fists and feet. With Gregorius beside him, Jake reached the narrow mouth of the wadi, where it debouched into the saucer-shaped valley of the wells. Like the wall of a dam, the two of them linked arms and managed to hold the flood of humanity there for a minute or two, but the pressure from those straining forward from the rear threatened to sweep them away, while the mood changed from high-spirited curiosity to angry resentment at this check upon their efforts to join the hundreds of their comrades who had already passed out of the wadi and were streaming out across the open valley. At the moment when they were swept aside, the firing began out there, upon the slopes of the valley, and instantly the mob froze and their voices died away. There was no further forward movement, and Jake turned and scrambled up the steep side of the wadi for a better view out into the valley. From there, he watched the slaughter that turned the valley into a charnel house. He watched with a sick fascination that changed slowly, as minute after minute the guns continued their clamour. He felt it become anger and outrage that outweighed all else, so that he was hardly aware of the slim, cold hand that sought his, and he glanced down only for an instant at Vicky's golden head at his shoulder, before turning his entire concentration back to the dreadful tragedy being played out before them. Vaguely, he was aware that Vicky was sobbing beside him, and that she'd gripped his hand so tightly that the nails were driven deep into his palm. Yet even in his dreadful anger, Jake was studying the ground and marking the Italian positions. On his other hand, Gregorius Mariam was praying softly, his smooth young face turned to a muddy grey with horror, and the words of the prayer forced between tight lips like the last breaths of a dying man.
"Oh, God,"
whispered Vicky, in a tight, choked voice, as the mortar bombing began, dropping relentlessly into the depressions where the survivors huddled for shelter.
"Oh, God, Jake, what can we do?"
But he didn't answer, and it went on and on. They were caught in the nightmare of it, powerless in the grip of this horror, watching the mortars continue the hunt until the woman with her two infants burst out into the open, not 300 yards ahead of them.
"Oh, God, oh, please, Jesus," whispered Vicky. "Please don't let it happen. Please make it stop now."
The guns hunted the woman and they watched her die, and the child rise to its feet and stand lost and bewildered beside the mother's corpse. The thud of galloping hooves sounded in the wadi below them, and Gregorius swung around and cried,
"Sara, no!"
as the girl rode out, crouched low over the stallion's neck. She rode barebacked, a tiny dark figure on the big white animal.
"Sara!"
Gregorius cried again, and would have followed her, running out alone into that deadly plain, but Jake grabbed his arm and held him easily, though he struggled and cried out again in Amharic. The girl rode on unscathed through the storm of fire, and Vicky's breathing stopped as she watched. It was impossible that Sarah could reach the child and return. It was stupid, so stupid as to make her anger leap even higher. And yet there was something so moving about that frail, beautiful child riding out to her death that it filled Vicky with a sense of her own inadequacy, a sense of general humility. For even in this proud moment, she was aware that she was incapable of such sacrifice. She watched the stallion rear, and the girl lean out to gather the small brown infant, saw the machine guns find their target at last, and the stallion whinnied and went down in a tangle of flailing hooves, pinning both the girl and the child, while the bullets continued to spurt dust and slap loudly against the still-kicking body of the stallion. Gregorius was still struggling and blabbering his horror, and Jake turned and struck him an open-handed blow across the face. "Stop that!" Jake snarled, his own anger and outrage making him brutal. "Anybody who goes out there is going to get his ass shot off." The blow seemed to steady Gregorius. "We have to get her, Jake. Please, Jake, let me fetch her." "We'll do it my way," snapped Jake. His face seemed carved from hard brown stone, but his eyes were ferocious and his jaws clamped closed with his anger. Roughly, he shoved Gregorius ahead of him down into the wadi, and he dragged Vicky after him. She tried to resist, leaning back against his strength, her head turned towards the plain and her reluctant feet sliding in the loose earth.
"Jake, what are you doing?" she protested,
but he ignored her. "Well, mount the guns. Won't take long." He was planning through his rage as he dragged them back along the wadi to where the cars were parked beyond the caves. Vicky and Gregorius were helpless in the ferocity of his grip, swept along by his strength and his anger. "Vicky, you'll drive for me. I'll serve the gun," he told her. "Greg, you drive for Gareth." Jake's breathing was shallow and fast with his rage. "We can only man two cars. One we'll use as a diversion. You and Gareth swing south along the back of the ridge. That'll keep him busy while I and Vicky pick up Sara and as many of the others as we can find alive." The two of them listened to him and were swept forward with a fresh urgency. As they ran back along the wadi, a final brief storm of machine gun fire and exploding mortar bombs preceded the deep, aching silence which now fell over the desert. The three of them turned the final bend in the course of the wadi and came upon a scene of utter pandemonium. The ravine was filled solidly with those who had escaped the Italian fire, struggling to load their possessions, their tents and bedding, their chickens and children, onto the panicky, bellowing camels and the skittering, braying mules and donkeys. Already hundreds of riders were galloping away, climbing the sides of the wadi or disappearing into the labyrinth of broken ground. New widows wailed in the uproar, and their grief was catching. The children shrieked and whimpered in sympathy, and over it all hung a blue miasma of smoke from the cooking fires and dust from the trampling hooves and milling feet. The four cars stood in their solid, orderly rank, aloof from the masses of humanity, gleaming in their coats of white paint with the vivid red crosses emblazoned upon their sides. Jake pushed a way through for them, towering head and shoulders above the throng, and when they reached the nearest car, Jake grasped Vicky around the waist and swung her easily up into the sponson. For a moment, his expression softened. "You don't have to come," he said. "I guess I went a little mad then." "You don't have to drive. Gareth and I'll take one car." Her face was deathly pale also, and there were deep bruised smears under her eyes from a night without sleep and the horrors of the slaughter. Her tears had dried, leaving dirty smears down her cheeks, but she shook her head fiercely. "I'm coming," she said. "I'll drive for you." "Good girl," said Jake. "Help Gregorius top up. We'll need full fuel tanks. I'll get the Vickers." He turned away, shouting to Gregorius. "We'll use Miss Wobbly and Tenastolin. Vicky'll help you refuel." A detail from the Rassi's personal bodyguard were already bringing the wooden cases of weapons and munitions out of the storage cave as Jake arrived. Each case was carried between four straining troopers to where the camels knelt. It was then lifted into the pannier on each side of the hump and hastily lashed down.
"Hey, you lot!"
Jake came up with a group carrying a crated Vickers. "Bring that lot along this way." They paused in their labours, not understanding until Jake made unmistakable signs, but at that moment a captain of the guard hurried up to intervene. After one shouted exchange, Jake realised that the language barrier was insurmountable. The man was obstinate and time was wasting.
"Sorry, friend," he apologised, "but I'm in a bit of a hurry."
And he hit him a roundhouse clout that ended the argument conclusively and sent the man flying backwards into the outstretched arms of two of his men.
"Come along."
Jake pushed the guards with the crate towards where the cars stood. The thought of Sara lying out there in the valley was driving him frantic. He imagined her bleeding slowly to death, her bright young blood draining away into the sandy soil, and he hustled the two men forward through the press of animals and human beings. As he came up, Gregorius was swinging the crank handle on Miss Wobbly, and the engine caught and ran smoothly as Vicky eased back the ignition.
"Where's Gareth?"
Jake shouted.
"Can't find him," answered Gregorius. "We have to go in one car."
And then both of them swung round at the familiar bantering laugh. Gareth Swales was leaning nonchalantly against the side of the car, looking as unruffled and calm as ever, his hair neatly combed, and the tweed suit as immaculate as if it had just come from his tailor.
"I say," smiled Gareth,
crinking his eyes against the drift of blue smoke from the cheroot between his lips.
"Big Jake Barton and his two eager ducklings about to take on the entire Italian army."
Vicky's head appeared in the driver's hatch.
"We've been looking for you,"
she shouted furiously.
"Ah!" quoth Gareth, lightly. "We will now hear from the Girl Guides Association."
"Sara is out there," Gregorius ran to Gareth. "We are going to fetch her. You and I will take the one car, and Vicky and Jake the other."
"Nobody's going anywhere."
Gareth shook his head, and Gregorius seized the lapels of his suit and shook him urgently.
"Sara, you don't understand. She's out there. We have to fetch her."
"I say, old lad, would you mind unhanding me?" murmured Gareth,
and removed Gregorius' hands from his lapel.
"Yes, we know about Sara, but..."
Vicky yelled from the driver's hatch.
"Leave him, Gregorius. We don't need anyone who's afraid."
And Gareth straightened up abruptly, his expression grim and his eyes snapping.
"I've been called many things in my life, my dear young lady. Some of them justified, but nobody has ever called me a coward."
"Well, there's always a first time, Buster,"
shouted Vicky, her face crimson with anger and streaked with dirt, her blonde hair ruffled and hanging into her eyes, and she pointed one quivering finger at Gareth.
"And for you, this is that first time."
They stared at each other for a moment longer before Lige Mikhail strode between them, his dark face set but commanding.
"Major Swales is acting upon my express orders, Mrs. Camberwell. I have ordered that the cars and all my father's troops will fall back immediately."
"Good God, man!"
Vicky transferred her anger from Gareth to the prince.
"That's your daughter lying out there."
"Yes,"
said the prince softly.
"My daughter on the one hand, my country on the other. There is no doubt which I must choose."
"You're not making sense," Jake interposed roughly.
"I think I am."
The prince turned to him, and Jake saw the dark torment in the man's eyes.
"I cannot make a hostile move. It's what the Italians are seeking. An excuse to attack in full strength. We must turn the other cheek now, and use this atrocity to win world support."
"But Sara,"
Vicky interrupted,
"we could pick her up in a minute."
"No," the prince lifted his chin.
"I cannot show the enemy these new weapons of ours. They must remain hidden until the time is right to strike."
"Sara!"
cried Gregorius.
"What of Sara?"
When these machines and the new guns are safely on their way back to the Sardi Gorge, I shall ride out myself to fetch her body," said the prince with a simple dignity. "But until then, my duty must come first." "One car," pleaded Gregorius, "for Sara's sake."
"No, I cannot use even one car," said the prince.
"Well, I can," snapped Vicky, and her tousled golden head disappeared into the driver's hatch. The engine roared, and Miss Wobbly shot forward, scattering men and animals before her, and swung in a tight, sliding right-hand turn towards the course of the wadi. Unarmed and alone, Vicky Camberwell was going out to face the machine guns and the mortars, and only one man amongst them acted swiftly enough. Jake shouldered the prince aside and sprinted across the circle of the car's turn, coming alongside a moment before it plunged into the narrow ravine. He got a grip on one of the welded brackets above the engine cowling, and although his shoulder joint was almost wrenched from its socket, he swung himself up and fell belly down across the sponson. Clinging grimly onto the leaping, bouncing vehicle, he dragged himself forward until he could peer down the driver's hatch.
"Are you crazy?" he bellowed.
And Vicky looked up and gave him a fleeting but angelic grin.
"Yeah, how about you?"
A heavier impact came up through the chassis of the car and momentarily drove Jake's breath from him so that he couldn't answer. Instead, he clawed his way up the side of the turret, almost losing four fingers as the loose hatch cover slammed closed at another leap of the car. Using all his strength, Jake lifted it again and secured the retaining catch before he scrambled down into the cab. He was only just in time, for at that moment, Vicky drove the car at full throttle out into the valley. The sun was clear of the horizon now, smearing long dark shadows across the golden sands. Dust and smoke from the mortar barrage still drifted in a stately brown cloud over the ridge, and the bodies of the dead were thrown at random across the bare plain. The women's dresses made bright splashes of colour against the monochrome of the desert. Jake swept a swift glance around the ridge that commanded the plain and saw that many of the Italian troopers had left their trenches. They wandered in small groups around the edges of the slaughter ground, and their movements were awed and timid. Green troops, still not hardened to the reality of open wounds and twisted corpses. They froze in attitudes of surprise as the car burst out of the wadi and flew on dusty wings towards the nearest waterhole. It took many seconds for them to move, and then they turned and pelted for their earthworks, tiny figures in dark uniforms with legs and arms pumping in frantic haste.
"Turn broadside!" yelled Jake. "Show them the crosses!"
And Vicky reacted swiftly, swinging the car into a tight left-hander that had her up on two wheels, sliding broadside in the sand, displaying to the Italians the huge scarlet crosses on the hull.
"Let me have your shirt!" Jake yelled again.
It was the only white cloth they had with them.
"I need a flag of truce!"
"It's all I have on," Vicky shrieked back. "I'm bare underneath."
"You want to be modest and dead?" howled Jake. "They'll start shooting any moment now."
And she steered with one hand as she unbuttoned her shirt front and leaned forward in the seat to yank the tails out of her skirt. She shrugged out of it and reached up into the turret to hand him the bundled shirt. Each time they hit another bump, Vicky's breasts bounced like rubber balls, a sight that distracted Jake for a hundredth part of a second before chivalry and duty recalled him, and he stood high in the turret, arms stretched above his head, streaming the white shirt like a flag, balancing with the sailor's legs against the wild antics of the car. To the hundreds of men who lined the parapet of the Italian trenches, Jake displayed two emotive symbols, the Red Cross and the white flag, symbols so powerful that even men in the white hot must of the blood, lust, hesitated with their fingers still curled about the triggers of the machine guns.
"It's working!"
shrieked Vicky, and swung the car onto its original heading, almost throwing Jake from his precarious roost in the turret. He dropped the shirt and clutched wildly at the combings of the turret, the shirt floating away like a white egret on the wing.
"There she is!"
Vicky cried again.
The carcass of the white stallion lay dead ahead, as she braked hard and then pulled the car to a standstill beside it, interposing the armored body of the car between the pile of bodies and the watching Italians on the ridge. Jake dropped down into the cab and crawled back to open the rear double doors of the car, knocking open the locking handles as he called over his shoulder,
"Keep your hatch battened and don't for Christ's sake show your head."
"I'll help you," Vicky stated boldly.
"The hell you will,"
snapped Jake, tearing his eyes off her magnificent chest.
"You stay where you are. Keep the engine running."
The doors flew open and Jake tumbled head first out onto the sandy earth. Spitting grit from his mouth, he crawled swiftly to the carcass of the white horse. Close up, the hide was shaggy and flea-bitten, dappled with faint patches of chestnut. On this pale background, the bullet holes were like dark red mouths, where already the metallic blue flies clustered delightedly. The stallion lay heavily across Sara's lower body, pinning her face down to the earth. The naked boy child had been hit by one of the hooves as the horse fell. The side of the tiny bald skull had been crushed, a deep indentation above the temple into which a baseball would have fitted neatly. There was no chance that he still lived, and Jake transferred his attention to the girl.
"Sara,"
he called, and she lifted herself on her elbows, looking back at him from huge, terrified dark eyes. Her face was smeared with dust, the skin shaved from one cheek where she'd slid against the ground, exposing the pale pink meat from which lymph leaked in clear liquid beads.
"Are you hit?"
Jake reached her.
"I don't know,"
she whispered huskily, and he saw that the satin of her breeches was soaked with dark blood. He placed both feet against the carcass of the horse and tried to roll it off her legs, but the dead weight of the animal was enormous. He would have to stand taking his chances with the guns. Jake came to his feet and felt the cold fingers of fear brush lightly along his spine as he turned his back to the nearest Italian trenches and stooped to the horse. Crouching, with his weight balanced evenly on the balls of both feet, he took the tail and the lower hind leg of the animal. Lifting and turning with all his strength, he began to roll the carcass off Sara's legs and pelvis. She cried out in pain, such a sharp, high-pitched shriek that he had to stop. She was praying incoherently in Amharic, weeping slow, fat tears of agony that cut runnels through the pale dust on her cheeks. Jake panted.
"Once more. I'm sorry."
And he braced himself. At that moment, Vicky yelled from the car.
"Jake, they're coming. Hurry. Oh, God, please hurry."
Jake swung around and ran to the car, peering over the high engine compartment. With a long plume of pale dust boiling out from behind it, a large open vehicle, crowded with armed men, was dropping swiftly down towards them from the ridge.
"My God,"
grunted Jake, screwing up his eyes against the low blinding rays of the morning sun.
"It can't be."
But even at that range, in the dust and bad light, there was no mistaking the gracious and dignified lines of a Rolls-Royce. Jake was seized by a feeling of unreality, that amid all this horror should appear something of such beauty.
"Hurry, Jake!"
Vicky's voice spurred him on, and he ran back to the dead horse, seized its hind legs and began wrestling it onto its back with the girl's agonized cries as an accompaniment. Grunting and straining, Jake lifted the horse by main strength until it was balanced critically along its spine with the legs pointed loosely at the morning sky. And now he could hear the approaching engine beat of the Rolls and the faint but excited voices of its occupants. He denied the temptation to look around again and instead let the canvas flop heavily over onto its other flank, freeing the frail body of the child woman beneath it. Still panting with his efforts, Jake dropped onto one knee beside her. She was hit in the upper leg. He saw it once. The entry wound was 6 inches above the knee, and when he felt swiftly for a bone break, there was another quick flood of dark crimson blood that poured warmly over his fingers and drenched the thick satin of her breeches afresh. Jake found the exit wound in the inside of her thigh, but knew by feel and instinct that it had missed the bone. Still, she was losing blood heavily, and he inserted a forefinger into the tear in her breeches and ripped the cloth cleanly to the ankle. He pulled it up, exposing her long, slim leg to the crutch. The wound was deep and blue in the darkly lustrous flesh, and Jake tore the flapping trouser leg free and wound one quick turn of it around the thigh above the wound. Using both arms and the strength of his shoulders, he drew the crude tourniquet so tight that the flow of blood was instantly stemmed, and he tied the ends of the bandage with two swift turns, and then looked up, just as the Rolls-Royce skidded to a violent halt across the front of the armored car. There seemed to be a state of utter confusion amongst the occupants of the Rolls, and again Jake felt a sense of unreality. In the front seat, the driver gripped the steering wheel in one hand and a rifle in the other, with white knuckles and fingers that shook like those of a man in fever. His ashen face was shining with the sweat, either of some terrible fever or some equally terrible terror. On the seat beside him crouched a small, wiry figure with a rifle slung over one shoulder, with a brown, wizened monkey face, partly obscured by a square black Leica camera with an enormous bellows lens. In the back seat of the Rolls was a large, powerfully built man, with a granite face and the level, controlled manner of a man of action. A dangerous man, Jake recognized instantly. And he saw that he was a major. He held a rifle in one hand, and with the other was trying to help to his feet a smaller, more handsome man, in a splendid uniform of elegantly tailored black gabardine, adorned with silver badges and insignia. On this officer's head, a brimless black helmet with a silver skull and crossbones rode at a jaunty angle, like a pirate in a Christmas pantomime, but the face below it was fixed in the same pale emotion as that of the driver. It became clear to Jake that the last thing this gallant wanted was to be helped to his feet. He was curled up in the corner of the seat in such a way as to offer the smallest possible target, and he slapped petulantly at the major's helping hand. Protesting shrilly and brandishing an expensively plated and engraved pistol, it was clear that his presence in the Rolls was by no means voluntary. Jake stooped over the body of the girl and slipped one arm under her shoulders and the other beneath her knees, careful not to inflict further hurt. Jake stood up with her in his arms while she clung to him like a child. This action caused the big stern-faced major to turn all his attention on Jake, to level his rifle at him and call a peremptory order in Italian. It was clearly an order to stand where he was, and looking into the muzzle of the rifle and into the pale, expressionless eyes, Jake knew that the man would shoot without hesitation if he were not immediately obeyed. There was a deadliness, a quiet aura of menace about him that chilled Jake as he stood with the slim, warm body in his arms, and he collected his senses and his words. "I am American," he said firmly. "American doctor." There was no recognition in the major's expression, but he turned his head and glanced at the officer, who stirred receptively, half rose in his seat, then thought better of it. He sank back again, speaking carefully around the bulk of his major. "You are my prisoner," he cried, his voice unsteady, but his English clear and unaccidented. "I place you in protective custody." "You're contravening the Geneva Convention." Jake tried to make his tone indignant as he sidled towards the invitingly open rear doors of the car. "I must inspect your credentials." The officer was recovering rapidly from his recent indisposition. Fresh colour flooded the classically handsome face, new interest flashed in the dark gazelle eyes, and the smooth baritone voice gained strength and a fine ringing timbre. "I, Colonel Count Aldo Belli, command you to account to me." His gaze switched to the huge steel body of the car. "This is an armored vehicle of war. You fly false colors, sir." As the Count spoke, he realized for the first time that neither the big curly-headed American nor the big old-fashioned vehicle which towered over them was armed. He could clearly see the empty gun mounting in the turret, and his courage came flooding back. Now at last he leapt to his feet, throwing out his chest, one hand on his hip, the other aiming the pistol at Jake. "You are my prisoner," he declaimed once more. Then, from the corner of his mouth, he growled at the front seat. "Gino, quickly! A shot of me capturing the American!"
At once, Excellency.
Gino was focusing the camera. I protest, shouted Jake, and sidled another few paces towards the inviting rear doors of the car.
Stay where you are,
snapped the Count, and glanced at Gino. All right, he asked.